From the Sky News Centre at 5. 2 days before Remembrance Sunday, 4 men have been arrested over what's understood to be an alleged UK terror plot. The suspects, aged between 19 and 27, were detained last night at locations across West London and Buckinghamshire. Our reporter Tom Parmenter is outside one of the properties raided in High Wycombe.
It was around 7 to 7:30 yesterday evening when armed police surrounded this property. They knocked on the door, didn't get a response. They were about to go in with some force, but then a woman inside the property opened the door, allowed the police to go in, and they've been inside conducting searches ever since.
The Shadow Chancellor has accused George Osborne of taking the British people for fools after he claimed a £1.7 billion bill owed to the EU has been halved. Following talks in Brussels, the government will now pay £850 million of it by next September, but the rest will come out of a rebate in 2016. Detectives in South Wales say they're supporting the family of a young woman killed in a homeless hostel. Their actions are being investigated by the police watchdog because the murder suspect they tasered later died. The Court of Appeal has thrown out an attempt by Max Clifford to have his jail term for historical indecent assaults reduced. The former publicist was sentenced to 8 years in May. Ed Miliband insists he's proud to lead Labour into the next election after reports of a leadership crisis. In a statement on Facebook, he says he relishes the fight, following claims two of his shadow cabinet ministers were making plans in case he quit. The shadow health secretary, Andy Burnham, insists Labour is united behind its leader.
I can only conclude that it's part of a deliberate effort that's underway to destabilise the Labour Party. Perhaps a certain interest fear that we will win next year. Well, I can say this to them. We're fighting hard and we will win. We're united behind Ed.
That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to PCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Horfield, Ollie Mead. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. And I think we've got, it's 5 weeks now since we asked to try and get the heads cleaned, the lasers cleaned on our CD players. I'm sorry, we're not going to have our theme, are we? Anyway, after the 6 o'clock news, yes, it's Remembrance Sunday this weekend. And with the fallen of so many different conflicts, what exactly is Poppy Day today? We speak to one ex-soldier who's worried about increasing sponsorship of Poppy Day by the arms industry. And tomorrow, Bristol takes on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that is TTIP for short. It's a trade deal which threatens to make voting totally pointless across the Western world. We hear all about it from Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth, plus the maker of the Lockerbie film we featured last week, that's The Maltese Double Cross, Alan Frankovich. What did he make after 3 decades making films all about the CIA? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. So on to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight it's lows of 7 degrees Celsius and some showers. This weekend highs of 13 degrees Celsius. Wet and windy on Saturday, but fairly sunny on Sunday. Next week there's highs of 13 Celsius, sunshine and showers this week with some gusty winds. Next weekend, the 15th and 16th of November, highs of 10 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's a Labour councillor for Horfield, Ollie Mead. Hi, Ollie, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, you're a new councillor to the city. You were elected, I think, in May. How have you found your first 6 or 8 months of being a city councillor?
Well, it's hard work, but I've had a lot of support. The good thing about being in the Labour Party is that we have quite a big group of councillors, and there's been a very good training programme for all councillors, but having experienced people to turn to and ask questions of is always very, very useful.
What's your background? Where did you come to politics from, and what sort of professionally?
Well, professionally is ironic. Before the election, I was unemployed, so I was very disaffected with how politics was working. But I did find that in the Labour Party in Bristol, it was a very welcoming organisation, and that people who really cared about making Bristol and Britain more widely a better place.
So you've gone from the Dáil into running the city?
Well, not quite running it. I think under the constitution, the mayor and the officers technically run the city. I just get to criticise them when they're doing naughty things or trying to.
And does anyone listen to that criticism?
They do, actually, and it's because I'm a difficult person to ignore, both in terms of because you can tell I'm quite a big person, and also because I'm capable of being quite noisy.
Okay, so I don't imagine you've been unemployed forever. So what sort of work have you done in the past?
Well, in the past, I've had all sorts of jobs. My last paid job proper was working in schools, and I used to do a lot of art workshops with youngsters. And I was really useful because it meant the one day a week I was in a particular school, they could offload all the naughty children on me, and I could keep them occupied for quite a while the teachers got on with making sure that the rest of the class could learn what they needed to on the curriculum.
Okay, so you've worked in schools. Where else?
I worked in a post office for a while, for a couple of years, and that was quite nice in that it's a community hub, so you get to meet a lot of people.
Sounds to me like you're quite interested in public service, doing public service type jobs like education, post office, rather than commercial sector. Why is that?
That's a good question. I don't think I'm a very good fit for the commercial sector. I had an interview with one of the major banks a few years ago.
Go on, which one? And
I think it was RBS.
Right.
And after the interview, the agency that had sent me received a phone call asking them why I'd been sent to them, because I wasn't a good fit for banking, apparently.
Why was that?
I don't know, but judging by the banking crisis that happened, it may be that I'm a little too straightforward. I'm not that motivated, perhaps, by profit margins either, so...
Well, you're not going to make lots of money for the commercial sector then, are you? Okay.
Well, I'm not going to make much money out of being a councillor either, to be honest.
We've had a sort of running discussion on here over the last couple of weeks about the merchant venturers. You know, for example, we've got a city, one of the streets in the city is called Baldwin Street. Just so happens that Baldwin was the first... he was the first king of Jerusalem, put there by the Crusaders and, you know, the Templars, that kind of thing. And Bristol, of course, is a Templar port. Years ago, used to have those great big sailing ships with the great white sails with the red Maltese cross on them, sitting in the harbour there. Now, I may be being a bit cruel to compare the merchant venturers to the Knights Templar, but they do seem to be the sort of elite of the city. What's your thoughts about how much power they really have these days?
I honestly don't know. I mean, to be honest, apart from allegedly George Ferguson, I don't see merchant venturers at any of the meetings I go to.
He's an ex-merchant venturer. He's, I think, one of the only people ever to have actually resigned from the merchant venturers. Most people are clamouring to join it.
Well, I can't say that I'm clamouring to join it, but I suspect that they wouldn't want me anyway. But no, I don't have any dealings with them personally. I tend to deal mostly with council officers and indeed members of the public, because that's what I'm there to do.
Well, let's hear a little clip now from a documentary from 1995 made by good old HTV, their head of news and current affairs, James Garrett, when it used to be making programmes, documentaries, dramas, all sorts, HTV. Now it's just ITV West and their news bulletin pretty much. Doesn't seem to be a lot else produced by them. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the introduction to the documentary West Eye View back in 1995 about the merchants. Whilst I'm finding that clip from elsewhere somewhere, Ollie, give us an idea of what committees you're on now.
Right, well, pretty soon after the election, I ended up being put forward for the planning committee, one of the two planning committees, and also the Business Change and Resources Scrutiny Committee, which looks at the budget, and they call it the Business Change Programme, but basically the way they're reorganising the internal structure of the City Council. And I also sit on the Audit Committee.
Well, tell us about the changes that the City Council is going through. I know there's quite a lot of officers seem to have gone and new officers coming in at the moment.
Yeah, they've had quite a number of new officers, although that's not hugely uncommon. I read Private Life pretty regularly, so you often have musical chairs going on at city halls around the country. But there have been quite a few people laid off as part of the government-imposed cuts, and so departments have had to try and reorganise themselves to try and provide the service that people need, but on a much tighter budget than before.
Okay, so this is the beginning of the West Eye View documentary by James Garrett on the merchant venturers, which aired way back in 1995.
To this day. For centuries, the society ran the port on behalf of the city council, becoming wealthy through the taxing of ships and goods. When this privilege ended in the 19th century, and along with it the importance of Bristol as a port, the merchants might have collapsed, as did similar groups elsewhere in Britain. They didn't. To this day, Bristol's biggest companies have a significant factor in common. Half the 8 board members at the Bristol and West, the 10th largest building society, are merchant venturers, including Christopher Thomas, President Sir John Wills, and Chief Executive John Burke. Mr. Thomas and Sir John are also directors of the Bristol Waterworks Company, 1 million customers across the West. In addition, Sir John is Deputy Chairman of the Bristol Evening Post Company, publisher of the West's biggest-selling local newspaper. Bristol's other major employers, like DRG, Imperial Tobacco and the Bristol Aeroplane Company, also drew many of their directors from the same small pool while they were locally owned. These prominent businessmen also play a leading role in the city's social, educational and political life. Many are even related to each other. Perhaps it's no surprise that the merchant venturers are referred to, albeit jokingly, as the Bristol Mafia. The society currently has 56 members, here filmed on the one occasion when they gather in public, the annual commemoration of their royal charter, granted by King Edward VI in 1552. The Charter Day service at Bristol Cathedral each November is attended by the merchants and pupils of 2 private schools in Bristol which they administer. Although many merchants, like Cabinet Minister William Waldegrave, are household names, the society doesn't publish a list of members, regarding it as a potential intrusion into their privacy. But slowly, times are changing. This is Merchants Hall, located on the edge of the Downs. We're the first television crew ever to be allowed to film inside the society's headquarters.
This hall here on Clifton Down is a replacement for the one that was bombed in the war, which used to be in Marsh Street in the middle of the city. Now, this, in fact, was 2 houses that the merchants bought after the war and put together to make one hall. This is the original coat of arms that was in the merchants' hall on Marsh Street. It was brought here after the war and put up and not repaired because Sir Winston Churchill, who was an honorary member, told us that we should keep it like this so people would remember what had happened in the war.
What does your motto mean?
Oh, well, it's very hard work if you're not a Latin scholar. Basically, it means that we eschew poverty.
And here, of course, you've got links with more modern-day members of the royal family.
Yes, these are the certificates of honorary members of the society. And amongst them, of course, you can see, for example, the Duke of Edinburgh, who is here, and some before him. And Winston Churchill was an honorary member. And over here is the only lady that's been an honorary member, is Mrs. Thatcher.
Well, obviously, lots of members of the establishment part of that organisation. The other thing, the reason I'm bringing up it again is because Monday's a very big day for the merchant venturers. I'm not sure if you knew that, Ollie, did you?
No, I didn't.
It's their Charter Day, which is the big annual event. They have what they call event at the Bristol Cathedral, Charter Day event, where a new merchant is installed, a master of the merchants. And that's happening at 11 a.m. at Bristol Cathedral. But I went onto Bristol Cathedral's website to see, you know, is it in their diary? No, it's not in their diary. But it happens every year, and it's happening on Monday. And we're hoping to speak to the new Master of the Merchants next week here. ultimately, though, you're having to deal with all the cuts that are happening. The merchants are incredibly wealthy. We heard in that little clip just now that they don't publish their membership list. Now they do publish their membership list nowadays. But there are questions about whether all of the members are actually published as part of that list. But how have you found implementing the cuts? Because these people are incredibly wealthy. I mean, the merchant venturers themselves, multi-millionaires, surely they could be helping out a little bit in the city in providing some of the services that the council can no longer afford.
Well, I would have said that the multi-millionaires in Westminster and the national government on the cabinet would have been better people and better placed people to actually help out with local people and actually funding properly local services. I can't speak for the merchant venturers because I have no idea about their financial situations, but I can honestly say that we have plenty of evidence that the vast majority of the current cabinet are multimillionaires, and it would be it seems they don't have an understanding of the real lives of people who perhaps aren't multimillionaires.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, bring you in here. What are your thoughts about this? Because these people, I mean, we heard last week, for example, from George Ferguson that the merchant venturers put a lot more into Bristol than they take out. Now, I would take issue with that, and it'd be interesting, quite interesting to look at the books of the merchants, because they have massive share portfolios in oil companies, public utilities, where ordinary people are actually paying over the nose, aren't they, for things like electricity and gas to feather the nests of shareholders like the merchants. So I wonder if actually maybe they're taking out of the city in terms of share dividends from the utilities, etc., and oil firms, more than they're putting back.
Well, if they are, they're only doing as much, as it were, as the generality of the wealthy classes. I mean, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations made a very pointed remark when he said that when men of business get together, even on social occasions, there is usually some conspiracy against the public being carried through. And I'm afraid that was Adam Smith, the torchbearer for free enterprise. And I'm afraid what's increasingly happened is we've got crony capitalism in this country. We used to talk about countries like the Philippines having crony capitalism. Britain has got crony capitalism. When the banks were bailed out in 2008, which was effectively bailing out all of the wealthy classes, if you were going to follow a free market policy as put forward by the Hayekians of the von Mises Institute, you let the banks collapse. But that means that wealthy people, including many merchant venturers, have to lose everything. And that's what the capitalist rule book says. But the capitalist rule book has been thrown in the waste paper basket. And we have basically been, for the last, under the coalition government and under the previous Labour government, the wealthy classes have had their assets protected by government intervention. And if, in actual fact, you could argue that in fact is a massive subsidy from the rest of the society to those wealthy classes. Because what should have happened at that point is the banks, following the rule book, the banks collapse and all these people lose their money and have to queue up outside the job centre. That didn't happen, although it may still do so.
Now, up at Filton, there's been a bit of a fiasco going on over the last couple of years, as if the building of thousands of some of the most jerry-built homes in the southwest, all over Filton Airfield now, as it's slowly being redeveloped instead of an airfield. It's a housing estate with, it seems, not enough infrastructure, causing all sorts of traffic problems around Filton too. The sacking of thousands of Rolls-Royce workers this week wasn't enough, which we'll be talking about in a moment. The chief executive of Airbus UK, that's Robin Southwell, has been forced to resign. As regular listeners will remember, Airbus are a subsidiary of one of the biggest arms firms in Europe, that's EADS, who were blocked from merging with BAE Systems last year by the government. Airbus's Filton factory was famously left off the map of European bases in last year's Airbus annual report, adding to speculation that Filton had been secretly earmarked for closure by the European Airbus bosses over in Toulouse in France. Anyway, Airbus UK's chief executive, Robin Southwell, has stepped down. And one of the contributing factors may have been a company he helped set up in November 2002 called Corporate Jet Industries. The company was created for the sole purpose of recovering a debt of £50 million, but ended up itself in the black to the tune of £150 million, three times the debt it was supposed to be collecting. When the company was declared bankrupt in September 2007. There have been suggestions by Corporate Jet Services creditors that the entire business and its £150 million debt may have been fraudulent and that this may have contributed to the resignation of the UK Airbus boss. The deal was just one part of at least £1 billion worth of alleged fraud now being exposed at HBOS Reading. That was taking place in the early noughties and being investigated by Thames Valley Police. Now, this sort of problem with Filton, I mean, it used to be a very successful airfield. Now it seems a lot of the jobs there are under threat. We've heard this problem with the chief executive resigning from Airbus, and also, of course, thousands of job losses announced up there. Now, this is a serious problem for the city, because this was traditionally part of the city's industrial heartland, where the jobs and the wealth of the city was coming from, Ollie.
Oh, sorry. Well, I'm not really sure what to say to that. I mean, the fact is that it was quite obvious to some of us that if you got rid of the airfield, then you were likely to jeopardise the jobs that were reliant on having a decent airfield nearby. But the trouble is, of course, you've got a very strange border between Bristol and South Gloucestershire. And I would always have hoped that if the airfield had and the rest of the area had been still part of the city of Bristol, we might have had quite a different attitude towards it and different opportunities there.
Martin, what's going on with air industry? Because it seems that we're turning into a service economy with service sector jobs, and Britain isn't really making things anymore.
Well, you've got to remember that in actual fact, a lot of what goes on at Rolls-Royce is in fact but final government consumption. A lot of what they're producing is military, and therefore in fact it's actually taxpayer money being spent on it. And you could argue that the jobs in military industry are in fact, you know, not that is the future, because there is no other future. But of course, you're totally dependent upon decisions about by military planners about what they do and do not want. And of course, games play behind the scenes between the US military industrial complex and the French and British subsidiaries of that military industrial complex. Nothing to do with Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and everything to do with government decisions about where we're invading next.
Okay, now 2,600 jobs have been announced as going at Rolls-Royce this week, and the Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, was at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week talking about it.
Mr. Jack Lopresti!
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday's announcement by Rolls-Royce of significant job losses across the country will devastate people and homes, and could well damage our national engineering skills base. Will my right honourable friend meet me and employee representatives from Rolls-Royce to see if we can try and minimise the effect of this by finding alternative engineering jobs and to preserve our vital engineering expertise? And can he reassure my constituents in Filton that he will continue to champion our world-renowned and world-class defence export manufacturing?
Yeah. I can certainly assure my honourable friend I'll do everything I can to champion companies like Rolls-Royce, whether in civil aerospace or in defence aerospace. I try and take them on as many of my trade missions as possible, because they're an absolutely world-class, world-beating company. Yeah. Obviously, it's disappointing that they plan to reduce the number of people they employ. It's not yet clear how many of those job reductions will be here in the UK. Of course, Rolls-Royce employ over 25,000 people here in the UK. And if we look at what's happened to the aerospace industry over the last 4 years, employment is up by 10%, exports are up by 48%, turnover is up by a fifth. So this is a successful industry that's being backed by our modern industrial strategy, but we need to do everything we can to make sure this company and others like it continue to succeed in the years ahead.
Well, I mean, it's trying to put a positive spin on things there, David Cameron, but Martin, it does look as if places like Filton are just simply going to be slowly, and are already being slowly, run down. That's just a reality we've got to face. The global economy is although the figures look good for the casino banking economy, the actual real economy is not looking so good. And we were talking, I think, 2 weeks ago about the ending of quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve Bank. Turns out, I didn't realise this, but actually at the same time, guess what? The Bank of Japan started doing quantitative easing. All right, well, maybe they ramped it up, because what's...
No, they didn't start. They've been doing it for years. They just decided to switch it on to full belt.
Okay, so they've accelerated their quantitative easing in a way to make up for the Federal Reserve reining back. What is going on in the macro economy here? Because a lot of this is just simply not filtering down to ordinary people, to jobs, that kind of thing. It seems to be staying in the casino economy, and also, to a lesser extent, maybe in stocks and shares.
Well, the quantitative easing effectively is a decision to prop up the markets. And in Japan, it's quite clear the government buys stocks and shares to prop up the stock market. It is suspected that the government of the United States also buys stocks and shares to prop up the stock market, although they never officially admit it. In Japan, they do admit it. And the other thing that they're doing is suppressing the gold price. So they're dumping gold futures in the middle of the night onto the gold futures market, which forces the gold price down. The reason they're forcing the gold price down is because it means that fund managers have to go into stocks and shares. That if you put your money in the bank, there's now a negative interest rate, for example, in the European Union, so your money will not gain any kind of... it will just get smaller and smaller if you just keep it in the bank. And that's true for ordinary savers as well. So everybody is being hurried into the stock market, which is effectively, for the little guys, like being sent to the slaughterhouse. Eventually it will crash, and all the little people who've been pushed into the stock market will lose everything. Because, of course, quantitative easing is just a way of kicking the can up the road. There is going to be a major capitalist crisis. There probably will be war associated with that, as we're seeing in Syria, Ukraine and the South China Sea. And I'm afraid the leadership of the Labour Party, at the minute, is still living in the past of... managing capitalism. Capitalism can't manage itself, so there's no reason why we should assume that we can.
Okay, from the South China Sea to the National Health Service, something a little bit closer to home. Before we hear from Ollie Mead, Labour councillor for Hawfield, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday and hear Ben Bradshaw, who's talking about his, is a Labour MP, talking about his problems in his constituency with the National Health Service.
Mr. Ben Bradshaw.
People in Devon face being denied operations if they're overweight or smokers, as well as the loss of all fertility treatment, cataract operations restricted to just one eye, and the closure of Exeter's very successful walk-in centre because of the unprecedented financial crisis facing my local NHS. Does he still think his massive and costly reorganisation has been a success?
Minister.
What we did by reducing the bureaucracy in the NHS is save £5 billion in this Parliament, and that is why nationally there are over 8,000 more doctors and 2,500 more nurses. We've only been able to do that because there are 20,000 fewer administrators in the NHS. Those are the figures. He may shake his head, but those are the figures. In terms of his local clinical commissioning group, it is getting an £18 million cash increase in the next year, and it's also going to get an additional £19 million through the Better Care Fund. So locally, there should be improvements in services rather than the picture he paints.
Mr. Stephen Lloyd.
Martin, what's happening with the National Health Service? Ollie, what's happening with the National Health Service? A lot of people are very worried about it. There was a story yesterday saying something like 50% of NHS trusts have had to have a bailout of some sort this year, emergency bailout from the Department of Health. So not looking too good.
No, but I think it's all part of the current government's plan. If you make the best value for money health service in the world, which was entirely funded by the taxpayer, start to look like it isn't run properly on financial basis, then you increase the argument for having privatisation by stealth. I mean, it's been what they've been doing all along. As there have been instances in private eye of hospitals which have been underfunded and then have ended up under private management, and then massive increase in their funding from the state. Well, if they'd increased the funding in the first place, you wouldn't have needed a private company to take over. So I'm not surprised at what the government is doing. I am disgusted by it. And I think it's a shame that what has been a world-class health system that we should be proud of is being downgraded by the government.
Martin, I'm just correcting my figures. It's actually only one in three NHS hospitals which needed government bailout funds last year. This is Charlie Cooper in The Independent this week. More than half £1 billion in government bailouts were paid to the NHS last year, as the number of hospitals in need of extra cash more than doubled, government auditors have admitted.
Well, if you think about it, the whole idea of having separate trusts which can run out of money and then needed to be bailed out is it's a silliness in the first place. You cannot allow a local hospital to go bust. It's the only provision in an area, and when we used to have a genuinely planned National Health Service, the hospitals which had extra resources, needed extra resources, were given extra resources. The idea that they should manage the hospital as if it were a business is wrong-headed in the first place. And of course it opens the door to privatisation by stealth, as Ollie has pointed out. And of course it is David Cameron who famously said before the last election, one of the few things he did promise, no top-down reorganisation of the health service. And I'm afraid come May next year, the electorate should remember that and realise that we were lied to, he was lying, and he's got to go.
On our next story, like it or not, the web provides a space to plan terror. This is GCHQ this week. The new director of GCHQ has been waxing lyrical about the dangers of terrorists using Twitter and Facebook to organise their terror attacks. Ollie, should we be worried? Should we be looking out on our Twitter accounts to see if we've got terrorists following us, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm sure if a terrorist actually started following me, they'd realise how boring my life is. So I feel a bit sorry for anyone at GCHQ who has to wade through my emails or look at Facebook and see yet another posting from a friend of mine of a dancing dog or a cat doing something funny. But in terms of, I mean, people use all sorts of methods for doing all sorts of things. I mean, most people use Facebook for keeping in touch with friends and family, and that's certainly what I use it for. But equally, of course, I mean, even political parties have websites and things, and we keep in touch with each other, or people let me know if there's a campaign day going on in Bristol to do with the general election. We all keep in touch that way. So I'm not surprised that perhaps terrorists may be using it, but I'd be interested to see what evidence they have, because if they're aware of quite a lot of terrorists using it, one would hope they'd be arresting them rather than just letting them carry on doing what they're doing.
What about the rather more serious, in my view anyway, accusation was being made this week? That is that GCHQ have been spying on communications between lawyers and their clients, and that actually there's no judicial process that they need to go through. If they want to have a look at emails between a lawyer and a client anywhere in the country, they're perfectly entitled to do so, and no one is going to stop them.
I can't say I'm surprised. I mean, I'd assumed that they probably monitor an awful lot of things. That's probably why they... I mean,
don't we have something called judicial privilege, where that's actually guaranteed a private conversation and guaranteed to be secret in law? And if you needed to put that kind of communication under surveillance, surely you've got to go in front of a judge, and if you don't, you're breaking the law.
I entirely agree with you, but I would say that what they might be thinking of is that the internet isn't, strictly speaking, a private place. It is a public place. That's why there's all the hacking that goes on. That's why people are worried about losing their ID details through banking fraud and things like that.
Yes, is it? I mean, if you're doing your banking on the internet, is that public?
Well, to an extent, I suppose it is, in the sense that people could probably tap into it. I mean, I've just been asked to sign a yet another petition about the putting online of medical records. People don't want the computerized system that could be hacked into by anyone. So it's kind of a tough thing. I'd say that in terms of the legal guarantee, it certainly applies for a private conversation, but whether or not GCHQ may well have permission to look at any kind of internet activity, and that might be why they're allowed to get around it.
Okay,
Martin. It's also what they do with it, though. One would hope that they aren't using it against people, that actually it's...
Well, fingers crossed.
Being monitored, but you don't
I mean,
know.
Why would they be putting a client and lawyer under surveillance if they didn't have some sort of intention to make a difference in that court case somehow, maybe by leaking it to the other side in the case? Martin, we've got two accusations here. One from the privacy campaigners saying, and lawyers, of course, saying, we don't want our conversations to be under surveillance between us and our clients, and neither do they. And actually, they're breaking the law, GCHQ, by doing this. And on the other side, GCHQ saying, well, actually, the terrorists are using Facebook and Twitter.
Well, GCHQ have been caught red-handed, effectively doing things which are outside the law. The Snowden revelations showed that they were carrying out surveillance which they had no legal authority to carry out. And therefore, they're going on the offensive now to defend their activities.
Okay, but how do you go and take GCHQ to court? Because you can't get hold of any of the evidence. They're a secret organisation. They're exempt from any kind of freedom of information.
Well, indeed,
like
and indeed. And of course, I keep banging on about this, as you know, Tony, but there is overwhelming evidence over the last few decades that NATO intelligence services have themselves been engaged in terrorist activities. So, for example, I'll just give a small example, a recent example, Mozan Beg, who was in Guantanamo, went to Syria recently, was clearly involved with jihadis and so on, was arrested by the West Midlands police when he returned, and he got off because his lawyers quite clearly pointed out that he was working for MI6 when he was in Syria. And the former French foreign minister, Roland Dumas, was on French television 2 years ago saying that when I was foreign minister, I was approached by British officials at an international meeting, and they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? And I would suggest out there in the real world, everybody knows that the British intelligence services have been infiltrating jihadis, some British, some of different nationalities, Libyans, a lot of Libyans, into Syria to try and overthrow the Assad regime. Now, if we're serious about tackling terrorism, we're going to have to start arresting some of the people inside the intelligence structure. People like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was a 14-year investigation into his activities in the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland by Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police. And last he was heard of was in the Green Zone in Iraq running something called the Joint Services Group, even though the British police had fingered him as a terrorist for running the Loyalist Terrorist Campaign in Northern Ireland. Now, if we're going to have a war on terror, and it's the government that says that we're going to have one, then we're going to get very serious about looking at all of the details about who have been doing exactly what. And I think the Syrian crisis shows absolutely clearly that British intelligence are involved in the commissioning of Islamist terrorism. And that means that certain generals and certain senior people are going to have to go to prison. Otherwise, it's just going to be war, isn't it? Just like in Ireland.
Now, we have also this week a lot of criticism of Ed Miliband, the Labour leader. Quite a lot of,
I mean, knew you were going to bring that
up. I do think it's rather a confected discussion. But let's listen anyway. Let's everyone make their own mind up, because we've got two Labour Party people in here. We've got a Labour councillor, Martin Summers, who's a member of the Labour Party. And I want to hear what you two and the listeners, and let the listeners make their own mind up, think of this exchange at Prime Minister's Questions between Ed Miliband and David Cameron. Because I think, actually, Ed Miliband could do better.
Mr. Speaker, my position on the referendum is exactly the same as his was before he lost control of his party. Now, I think we can take it from the answer to that question that the answer is none. He's got no allies. Now, he says his admiration for Angela Merkel is enormous. After the last couple of days, we can see the feeling is mutual, Mr. Speaker. If it's going so swimmingly, why do you think Chancellor Merkel has already rejected his proposals?
On that, he's completely wrong as well. She has herself said there are problems in terms of free movement that need to be dealt with. But he talks about support for a European referendum. Perhaps he'd like to address this. The former Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's decided to leave the House of Commons, yes, about the only person on the Labour benches who had any economic credibility, has said that a European referendum is inevitable. He says, and I quote, "It's a boil that has to be lanced." If it's inevitable, why is the Right Honourable Gentleman so frightened of the British public?
Well, the City AM today, saying David Cameron was told by three European prime ministers that there will be no change to the European free movement directives. Prime ministers of Sweden, Finland and Norway said the free movement of labour was a principle that will not be undermined in the EU. David Cameron was given the frank verdict of EU leaders during meetings in the Finnish capital of Helsinki at a summit of nine northern European countries. Ollie, your Labour councillor, what do you make of this? Because there are two questions, really. One about free movement of labour, whether this is good or bad. And secondly, on the performance of Ed Miliband at Prime Minister's Questions.
Well, I'll take the Ed Miliband question first, because I hadn't actually watched Prime Minister's Questions. I'm usually too busy when they're on. But he was making a very good point, though. I mean, David Cameron is accusing Labour of not having strong leadership, and yet David Cameron is the one who's had two MPs defect. He's the one who's got a terrible international reputation, and clearly not being supported by people you would think might be natural allies of him from centre-right governments across Europe on key issues. As for the free migration of people, I don't have an issue with it. It's at the heart of the European Union is the right to work overseas and to get experience of doing that. I have friends from the UK who are working in places like Sweden and Spain and other countries. And it creates a much more positive kind of atmosphere as well. The stronger the links between ordinary people in different countries and the more experience we get of other cultures, it just makes us much more open people. So,
but Ollie, you're living in dream world there, because what's happening here is that because of the mass immigration into the UK, the net immigration is enormously into Britain, not out of Britain. It means that what's happening is British people who did have jobs are being undercut by cheap foreign labour, and we're ending up with lots of British people actually being made redundant, and the actual terms and conditions, for example, pay and terms and conditions of work here have been eroded. Now, trade unions have been working to get high paying conditions in Britain for centuries, and that's all in the last few years being eroded by cheap foreign labour.
Well, it's not entirely being eroded by cheap foreign labour, it's being eroded by cheap employers. The TUC,
but
in
that's
the
what employers do. They will try and get the cheapest worker, to an extent.
But the employers are getting away with things that they're allowed to by a government that won't protect UK jobs.
Well, the New Labour never did either. New Labour did nothing to bolster trade union laws whatsoever.
But you're talking about a problem that has been very much in the public mind for the last couple of years. In terms of undercutting people for jobs, though, I mean, there are loads of people in the UK working on minimum wage. In fact, there's been more of an expansion in part-time minimum wage jobs than there has been in anything that people can afford to live on. And so that's down to employers. It's not down to to migration. And in terms of emigration from the UK, there are millions of British people living in other EU countries, particularly Spain. A lot of people retire down there.
We're talking about the workforce. We're not talking about retired people.
No, but we are. But we are talking about the free movement of people, and so therefore it applies to all people, not just one group or another.
Martin, what do you make of Ed Miliband's performance at Prime Minister's Questions and performance as leader? Are you a loyalist?
I am, actually. I am. I think he's a decent chap. He hasn't got everything right. I think he was wrong to rule out a discussion of decriminalisation of drugs, which the Liberals have picked up on. I think he was wrong about Ukraine. He's been wrong about that, along with the rest of the political class. But I think he did a very good job of keeping us out of a war in Syria over a year ago, although, of course, Kelsey's dropped the ball again by supporting the recent Dimash on that. But on the whole, I think he's actually a decent chap, and I think I'm pretty confident that he is actually going to end up as PM, because that's the way the numbers stack up. Now, on the free movement of labour, you'll notice there that there are three European PMs who've all chided David Cameron about this can't be changed, and one of those PMs is the PM of Norway. Norway isn't even in the European Union, but because they're outside the European Union, they've always been outside the European Union, because the Norwegian Labour Party took a good look at the European Union and decided it was too free market for them. But in actual fact, there's still free movement of labour in and out of Norway, because they've decided they want to do that for their own reasons. And of course, the Norwegians pay more per head into the EU budget than we do, because that's part of the deal that allows their exports to get free access to the European Union without a tariff barrier. Now, if we were to leave the EU, and I'm perfectly happy to discuss it, it's the sort of thing that Tony Benn and the late Bob Crowe were in favour of. Let's talk about it. But there's no free lunch. If you leave the EU, your exports will have to face a tariff barrier as they cross the channel, which means that some people in Britain will definitely lose their jobs. Now, we may have to raise taxes on the wealthy. When I was doing my... We could have a siege economy. We used to talk about this in the 1970s, the alternative economic strategy, where we just have a siege economy in Britain, we raise tariff barriers against the Europeans, and we trade with the rest of the world from behind a tariff barrier. There's a lot of strong case to be made for doing that, but it's not a free market case, and it's not a case that can be made by Conservatives with any kind of consistency.
Also, just going back to Ed Miliband, though, I mean, one thing I would say is he has been to Bristol a few times. He came during the mayoral election, and he's got a very nice way with him. He's a very nice, warm person. He seems to actually care about people. He does a good job on the doorstep. And a couple of years ago, when the phone hacking scandal was taking off, he was the only person in the party leaders of this country who had the guts to stand up to Rupert Murdoch's press empire and say that actually there should be a proper investigation. And that's probably why he's being attacked by the press all the time, that people are grinding axes.
You mentioned drugs, Martin. Theresa May, backed by David Cameron, after Lib Dem Norman Baker quits the Home Office. MP Norman Baker said the Home Secretary saw it as a Conservative department in a Conservative government. The PM praised her as a very effective politician. He was talking about it, Martin, working in the Home Office like walking through mud. And he's particularly resigned over the issue of drugs. A great big inquiry recommends decriminalisation of drugs.
It didn't recommend decriminalisation. It just said it just came up with some fairly anodyne, what I would regard as all basic stuff about drugs, saying that heavier criminal penalties do not reduce use, which is pretty clear from looking around the world.
I read was actually saying the government really does need to look at decriminalising.
I think
anyway,
the Liberals
anyway,
as a whole are saying.
Anyway, but, yeah. No, this is the report, the Home Office report that Norman Baker was helped produce, and then he found that the entire thing was kicked into the long grass, not just by David Cameron and the Conservatives and Theresa May, but also, as you said, by Ed Miliband, and he broke his spirit, really. He's thinking, well, look, all that's happening by criminalising drugs is this is an absolute gift, as it was in the 1920s in the United States during Prohibition, to organise crime. And by taking it away from the domain of organised crime and decriminalising it, regulating it, that we'll get somewhere. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of Norman Baker resigning over this?
Well, don't forget, Norman Baker was put in there by the Liberal Democrats so that he might resign at this point, so that they can put clear red water, I suppose you'd have to call it, between themselves and the Tories. And to be fair, I think the Liberal Democrats do deserve some credit here. They have been prepared to talk in an adult fashion about drugs in a way that the Tories never are, and I'm afraid our front bench don't seem able to get their heads around. The fact of the matter is that the money involved in the drugs industry is so large that the UN Office on Drugs and Crime said that the banking system in 2008 was effectively propped up by the drug cartels. That is the reality. And we can't go on like this, because countries like Colombia and Mexico are being plunged into chaos and misery because of the illegality of drugs. And overwhelmingly in Latin America, across the political spectrum, the idea of legalising drugs is gaining traction. And if you look at the elections in the US to the midterms elections, some the various places, including Washington, D.C., have voted to decriminalise marijuana. That Washington, D.C., it'll be like Amsterdam. That's the reality.
Ollie Mead, Labour councillor for Hawkfield. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, a lot of people are worried, saying, are we going to end up with people trying to sell heroin in Tesco's if Norman Baker gets his way?
Well, I couldn't comment on Tesco, although they do have a tendency to sell whatever they can. But I would say that with Norman Baker, I was amazed that finally the government, after 4.5 years, had reached the stage of being so right-wing that even a Liberal Democrat couldn't support it. I'm sure he's obviously trying to keep his seat at the next general election by reminding people that they shouldn't vote Conservative because he will be different than a Conservative, although he's been part of their government. I think that's pretty much how I feel about Norman Baker.
Okay, back to Prime Minister's question now. Michael Meacher also asked a question about the deficit. He's basically saying that Margaret Thatcher was running a higher deficit than the Labour government, the previous Labour government before this government, pre-2010, was doing.
Michael Meacher.
Since the Prime Minister likes to bang on about Labour overspending, is he aware... Is he aware that in Labour's 11 years before the crash in 2008, the biggest deficit was 3.3% of GDP, whereas the Thatcher major governments racked up deficits bigger than that in 10 out of their 18 years? So who were the overspenders? It's a no-brainer.
There's only one problem with what the right honourable gentleman said, which is the deficit they left and we inherited was 11.5% of GDP. It was bigger than almost any other countries anywhere in the world. And if you don't believe me, you can listen to your own shadow chancellor. And he said this: I think the fact you had the massive global financial crisis, which happened on our watch, meant that people saw their living standards hit. I don't think we'd be being straight with people if we only said it was the financial crisis. It was also after 13 years in government, we'd made some mistakes. There we have it. Some mistakes. You bet there were mistakes. Overspending, overborrowing, overtaxing, wasteful welfare, bloated expenditure, a complete and utter failure. And it's extraordinary they're still sitting there on the front bench.
Well, this is going to run and run, isn't it? But in actual fact, the deficit is in fact not being reduced as fast as Osborne said it was going to be at the beginning of the Parliament. And in fact, Ed Ball said you're not going to be able to reduce this deficit in one go. You're going to need to go to at least two Parliaments. And because, of course, if you try and reduce the deficit too fast, you push the economy into recession. And at that point, the deficit goes up anyway. And in actual fact, when you've got a recession, a deficit should go up. That's in fact what should happen. And if it doesn't go up, the economy starts to go down, and then the deficit goes up anyway. Now, the real problem, of course, is that the banks are bust. They've always been bust. They're still bust. And possibly before next May, they're going to crash. And at that point, do you know what will happen? The deficit will go through the roof on Cameron's watch.
Ollie?
Well, I mean, the deficit seems to have almost doubled over the last few years, and it's one of the interesting things to keep watching is the size of our national debt. Because although there are all these massive cuts going through, and apparently we can afford tax cuts for the very richest in our country, we somehow are also racking up massive debts along the way. The problem is, of course, the current government is following the Bush model of economics, which devastated the American economy earlier this century and helped contribute to the global financial crash.
But we heard at the end of October, the government borrowing is actually 10% higher than it was last year. So the deficit's actually going up. There was an interesting, if you sit and look at the figures, what Michael Meacher was talking about, of course David Cameron didn't actually answer the question he asked. He was saying this was the deficit before 2008. And by saying that, he was really identifying the fact that what happened in 2008 was that was the point at which the economy failed. And it's been failing ever since. Before 2008, we were talking about less than 3.3% of GDP borrowing. After 2008, we're talking about 11.5% of GDP. So a massive increase. Mm. And of course, it's not going down, is it?
No, and of course, the purpose of the reason why it's gone up is because we bailed out the financial sector, which effectively protects the income of the wealth of people like George Osborne, who's a millionaire, multimillionaire. If you were following, as I said earlier, if you were following the free market textbook, the banks should have been allowed to go down. Of course, ordinary people would have been thrown out of work and there would have been a lot
of
misery.
But would people use their money that they had in the bank there?
No, you've got to lose it. I mean, as we
hang on, hang on. Let's just get this straight, because you don't lose your deposit up to a certain amount, do
yes.
you? You lose if you're an investor in the bank in shares,
yes.
you lose that money.
And also, if you're the deposit insurance only runs up to 30 grand. So wealthy people like Osborne would have to lose everything except 30 grand. Murdoch would have to lose everything except 30
grand. It'd be an interesting leveller, wouldn't it?
It would indeed. And of course, we could have tried the free market experiment of letting it happen, but we decided not to. But of course, at that point, when you've bailed out the financial services sector, I don't want to hear another word about the free market economy and all the rest of it. It's just history. It's over. Free market capitalism of that kind is finished. It was finished as soon as we bailed out the financial markets. And when, of course, there is every possibility that the bubble that's been blown with using public resources, which has been a massive wealth transfer to the top 1% in the global economy. Oxfam pointed out the other day that 85 individuals own more than the whole of one half of humanity. And it's getting worse. The global crisis has made all of that worse. Now, what should be happening, if we're going to bail out the financial sector, is we should own it and control it. And that is what I suspect a Labour government will have to do if the crash happens after they come to power.
Okay, well, you're talking about the rich. I'm interested right now in the poor. Work, it seems, no longer offers a route out of poverty. Over half the families in poverty are also in work, we hear this week. That's why we need a living wage. Now, the living wage campaign has made great strides in the past year, but too many employers are dragging their feet, especially in retail. Earlier this year, it was reported over half the families living in poverty are also in work. When the living wage movement started over a decade ago, campaigners were often told it couldn't be done. Now, Ollie Mead, what are your thoughts about this? Because we keep hearing about the minimum wage, but it seems even the minimum wage is not a living wage.
No, well, the minimum wage is an interesting thing. I read somewhere recently that if the minimum wage had kept up with executive pay rises over the same time frame, it would be something like £18.50 an hour or thereabouts, give or take a few pence. So it hasn't kept up with other people's wage rises. But it's not just minimum wage that's the issue. It's also the fact, and although it is a big issue, it's also the fact that so many people are being forced to work part-time hours or to work on 0 hours contracts. And so people who are working are trying to get as many hours as they can and to earn as much as they can, but their employers won't let them, or they're tied into these contracts that really don't help them at all.
Martin?
Well, I mean, if you carry on forcing down the living standards of the poorest in the society, you're ultimately sawing off the branch that you are sitting on. The success of the US economy over many decades, and of the German economy even to recent times, is based upon high wages, high productivity, high levels of investment. And in the Norwegian and the Scandinavian countries, what they used to call solidaristic bargaining made sure that as capitalism became more productive through technological change, a substantial part of that increase was passed to the workers as wage increases because of strong trade unions. And that, in fact, was not at all undermining of capitalism. It made capitalism work well. Capitalism worked best during the 1945 to 1973 period, when real wages rose consistently, even in the US, because of strong trade unions and collective bargaining. Once you get rid of that, at the first, the capitalists love it. They get massive increases in their profit margins and all the rest of it. But of course, everybody's worker is somebody else's customer. And of course, if you keep driving down people's wages and cutting their benefits, eventually there's nobody to buy the stuff, is there? And that, of course, is where the root of the crisis lies.
Well, it's also part of the problem, though, with the idea of trickle-down economics, because usually it just trickles off to overseas bank accounts in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands, rather than actually into people's pay packets.
Well, thank you for saying that, because in The Guardian this week, Luxembourg tax files, how the tiny state rubber-stamped tax avoidance on an industrial scale. Leaked documents show that one of the EU's smallest states has been helping multinationals save millions in tax, also, of course, individuals, to the detriment of its neighbours and allies. The $870 million loan company, which is above a stamp shop. This is the sort of thing that's been going on. We've heard that there's going to be some sort of attempt to deal with it, but it doesn't seem to be happening, Ollie. This is tax avoidance we're talking about. You shift your money offshore and you pay virtually no tax on it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that I'm not surprised at all. I saw a very good program a few years ago where they had the town of Zug in Switzerland, which had more businesses located there than people living there. So, you know, big companies from the UK had to have something like one board meeting a year there to qualify as being based in Switzerland. It's doubtless the same in Luxembourg.
But this is legal, isn't it? I mean, if you were a company finance director, you'd be saying, actually, the best thing to do is if we put our money over there, then we won't have to pay tax on it.
Well, that's probably why I'm not a company finance director, is that I've never had a problem with the idea of paying tax, because I get to see the benefits of it in terms of things like the health service and other important bits of infrastructure. The problem also, of course, in part is that our government is funded in terms of its election campaigns by some of the very corporations or rich individuals who benefit from not perhaps being chased up so much on tax payments.
If political parties have got a vested interest in feathering the nests of these companies who are doing tax avoidance, it's never going to be dealt with.
Well, no, and it's getting worse and worse, because it's a negative cycle, isn't it? The more money they've got, the more money they've got to bribe the politicians with. The German tax authorities did a raid on Luxembourg a few years ago, where they just came over the border, hundreds of tax officials and police, and raided the Luxembourg banks. And when there was tax evasion in Monaco in the early 60s, and the people were going to Monaco to avoid paying their taxes in France, General de Gaulle sealed off the border and just refused to let anybody in or out until they paid up. And eventually, of course, if the banks collapse and we're drifting off to World War, people aren't going to be able to hide their money. We're going to put a gun to their head and we're going to have it off them.
That's one way of dealing with it. Have you got anything which is a little bit maybe less criminal as a way to deal with
it? No, it's
it,
not
Ollie?
Criminal. They're the criminals.
Well, it is if you put a gun to somebody's head.
Yeah, I'd say that all we need is a simple tax system. I mean, everyone seems to struggle with filling in their tax returns every year, and it's only the people who can afford the top class accountants who end up being able to avoid tax. So I'd say just have a simple taxation system that's easy to follow, so you know what you've got to pay on
what.
Well,
when you get above a certain income, it seems you're paying someone to make sure you pay virtually no tax, which is totally wrong.
But you
anyway,
could close the loopholes in order to make it simpler.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest. He's the Labour councillor for Horfield, Ollie Mead. After the news, it's Remembrance Sunday. But why are arms firms sponsoring Poppy Day?
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, critics are rounding on the Chancellor, who's claiming a victory for Britain in Europe. George Osborne says the UK will only pay half the £1.7 billion surcharge demanded by the EU. Two instalments totalling £850 million are being deferred until next year. Labour says the rest will have to be paid, but that's covered by a rebate Britain was certain to get anyway. David Cameron's playing that down.
This was far from inevitable because the bill has been halved, the bill has been delayed, no interest is being paid on the bill, and we've changed the rules so that this can't happen again, and that is very good news.
Four men have been arrested over an alleged Islamist terror plot thought to centre on the UK. They were taken into custody last night from addresses in West London and Buckinghamshire. One of them's in High Wycombe. Local youth worker Sadiq Deshmukh, who knows the suspect picked up there, is worried about the way the operation was carried out.
One of the concerns that we heard very, very early on in the morning was that it was a disproportionate use of a forced and armed response. Did it actually necessitate that? Was there a need for that to happen? So was there an actual threat on the ground? And that's a concern.
Police are trying to reassure people in the South Wales village of Argoed following a suspected act of cannibalism. A post-mortem examination on the 22-year-old victim, Carius Yem, is likely to take some time. The suspect died after he was tasered by police. Senior Labour politicians are dismissing rumours they held talks over a contingency plan if Ed Miliband quit as party leader. He's put out a statement on Facebook saying he relishes the fight again ahead of next year's general election. An overhaul of the Religious Studies GCSE has been announced. Under government plans, pupils who take it will have to study at least two faiths. And Taylor Swift has spoken for the first time about removing her music from Spotify. The singer says the music streaming website seems like an experiment she's not willing to contribute her life's work to. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Right now, the Ebola virus is devastating communities across West Africa. Thousands have died and many more are sick. We're working to help prevent the disease spreading with training, equipment and cleaning supplies. Please help now by going to the DEC website or calling 0370 6060 900 to make a donation. Thank you.